Welcome to Syntax, where we deliver tasty treats for web developers.
Welcome, everybody. How's everybody doing? Hopefully you're ready for another Syntax. Today we're going to be talking about JavaScript utility libraries, which it's truly a tasty treats episode because we're just going to rattle through, I don't know, a dozen or two different utility libraries, things that we use that make your life a little bit easier, things that make you go, huh, that's handy. So how you doing, Scott?
Oh, I'm doing really, really good here. Living the code life, coding, recording videos, you know, doing all that good stuff. How about you?
I'm doing good. Just getting ready for fall. It's almost the end of August here and starting to get the flannels out of storage and ready for prime time. So that's good. Anything special you're working on these days?
I'm working on that cart rebuild, the shopping cart rebuild, and I have some, I'm so excited to get this done because I don't know if you follow me on Instagram or anyone who follows me on Instagram will maybe see some of these like little sneak peeks I'm giving of it, but the thing is pretty sweet. It's in React, and it's, as it's mounting, it animates in from both sides. It like flies in a really interesting way and does some really like practical but nice effects while things are loading. It's obviously like, I'm trying to make it so it's, sort of inspo worthy, right? I want people to talk about it, but I don't want to make it totally overblown and totally, have those things get in the way. So I'm just working on that. I have the front end like 99% done, and I've started the API and backend for it, and it's cruising. I just got to get it done and then work on the subscriptions part of it all, and then you should be able to see it in the Level Up Tuts store soon, hopefully by next episode or two. Yeah. How about you?
So for the back end, I got a question about this. Did you end up going with Braintree for rewriting it?
Yeah, that's actually why I chose to rewrite it, is to go with Braintree to sort of simplify my offerings between PayPal and credit card, right? So before I was using Stripe for credit card, PayPal for PayPal, and managing two entirely separate APIs, really. And Braintree doesn't take away all of that pain so far, but it has made it really nice and easy. And I do like some of the things they offer. Like there's the hosted fields thing. I don't know if we've talked. We didn't talk about that in our episode because we hadn't really dove much into Braintree. But there's basically you code up some divs with IDs of fields and then say, hey, Braintree, these are going to be my secure fields. And then Braintree sort of injects a form iframe into that, but it uses the style of your divs as the style of the inputs. So you can have a really customized secure form or whatever, and without having to worry too much about what you're doing other than that.
That's pretty sweet. Another thing I was looking into, because we talked about one of the challenges of moving from Stripe to Braintree would be if you already have recurring billing happening in Stripe, how do you get it out? And apparently, if you do contact Stripe, they will migrate it for you to another approved vendor.
Interesting.
So it is possible to get that data out.
I was considering just something that we said. Maintaining a legacy subscription model. And just because, I mean, it works, so just keep it there and hold on to it.
Yeah.
But I'll have to look into that. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. So I thought that I don't even have recurring billing, but I just thought that was interesting to not be locked into one. So yeah,
nice.
On my end, I am full blown. I've been mentioning this a couple of times ago, but I sent an email out about it a couple days ago. I'm full blown working on a sort of an advanced React course, I think I'm going to call it, which is primarily focused around using GraphQL and charging credit cards. So I'm sort of deep into that, feeling a couple pain points. It's definitely early days for GraphQL and some of these services, so I'm definitely running into lots of like little hiccups along the way. I've logged a couple bugs in a couple of the libraries, nice. And they've since been fixed. So it's definitely early days for this stuff, but it's also starting to feel fairly stable. The stuff I'm finding is just minor little edge casey stuff. So pretty happy about that.
Nice. Yeah, that's got to be really exciting to dive into a bunch of new tech like that. So I'm really excited for this GraphQL episode we're going to do where Wes, who is, at this point much more knowledgeable, but is still a growing in it, and I haven't really dove into it at all yet, other than the basics of what it is. I'm going to just sit down and ask Wes a whole bunch of questions, and maybe we can take some questions we get over Twitter that people have over it too, and we can both try to solve and figure out what these answers are.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be a good episode, because I still will remember all of my questions about GraphQL, so we can talk about it as it's fresh, which is sometimes better than someone who's been in it for 4 or 5 years and it's all second nature to them.
Yeah, I find that to be the case most of the time.
Awesome. Well, let's kick it off with our libraries. We want to say thanks so much to FreshBooks for sponsoring. FreshBooks is cloud accounting software. We'll talk a little bit more about what they are. But if you go to freshbooks.com/syntax and sign up, you can get a 30-day free trial. So thanks so much to them for sponsoring. So today we're talking about JavaScript utility libraries. What is a utility library? Well, it's kind of this like loose idea of something that is not necessarily for maybe dealing with the DOM or not necessarily for processing payments, but it's just a library that helps you get stuff done. So whether that's working with a specific type of data, or maybe you have a task that is fairly repetitive that you need to do over and over again, these libraries make life a lot or a little bit easier on us. So probably the most popular utility library out there is a library called Lodash. And if you've never heard of it before, essentially it's just a collection, a huge collection of handy methods that allow us to work with different types of data. So there's a whole bunch of methods for dealing with arrays. There's a whole bunch of methods for dealing with objects, a whole bunch of methods for dealing with functions and functional programming, and all kinds of really nice stuff in it. So are you a Lodash user there, Scott?
Yeah, for a good amount of time. I feel like I caught the Lodash bug just as it was like firing up. I mean, for a long time, everyone was on Underscore. Lodash was sort of the second generation of something, a tool like Underscore. And yeah, I pretty much, at first, I remember seeing it and looking through these JavaScript functions back when I wasn't doing a ton of like heavy JavaScript stuff. I still wasn't doing any like single page application stuff. And I just remember thinking, yeah, maybe I'll use this, but none of this stuff seems super useful. And then I started doing this world of these larger JavaScript applications. And I remember the first time the light bulb clicked for me with Lodash, and I was just like, holy cow, this thing makes my life so much better. And ever since then, it's just been like a constant. You end up importing only what you need or whatever from Lodash, but there's just some things that it takes all of the guesswork out. It takes away all this like mundane sort of JavaScript stuff that you may have potentially had to memorize some sort of, you know, strategy, right? Even like finding a specific item in a collection of objects, right? You no more have to iterate over things like that. You can just find as if it was like even like a Mongo query or something like that, that sort of style. So I think Lodash is just one of those things that, man, when you start really utilizing the full power of it, it can just save you an endless amount of time. I mean, the best part is, too, they've already gone through and done all of these, you know, best practices and optimizing. And so you don't have to worry about whether or not the code's going to hold up because, you know, it's being constantly improved.
Yeah. Any time that you have like a specific set of data, whether it's an array of values, an array of objects, an object with that's deeply nested inside of each other. Anytime you're like, huh, this is either hard to work with, or I have the specific situation where I need to find an item inside of it, or flatten this data, or find the difference between two arrays. And it's all over the place. They have all kinds of really helpful little methods inside it. Anytime you have that question, more than likely there's going to be a Lodash method that lives inside of it. And sometimes you hear criticism for Lodash being like, well, you can do that with ES6, but really, if you dive into it and realize what all of the different methods are, maybe just spend 10, 20 minutes after this podcast or while you're listening to this podcast going through all the documentation and figuring out what all the different methods are. It's good to know that sort of everything that Lodash does. Then when you run into situations, you're not going to hack something together for yourself. You're just going to reach for whatever handy method lives inside of Lodash.
I was going to say, and those methods can just, they can increase your code readability, make everything way cleaner and easy to sort of understand. I mean, if you're writing your own version of all this stuff all the time, that code's going to take up a lot more space. But then if you're writing, let's say, a pull at, and you want to pull a specific object at something, you know, I mean, you could just drop in pull at or find or whatever, and it just drops in there instead of having to rewrite that code or having take up that space in your project.
Exactly. And dealing with unique values is what I used to do is I would always be like, huh, I need to like unique an array. Mm-hmm. So I would go to Stack Overflow, copy paste that little helper function. And then I'd have these like, I'd either have like a helper's file that had all these random different functions that were not necessarily battle tested. Maybe you run into a weird edge case at some point, or you're going to run into performance problems where you don't know if there's a memory leak or it's not the best way to approach this with an extremely large data set. John David Dalton, who is behind Lodash, he is extremely performance minded in all of this stuff. And where Lodash initially came from was there's another library called Underscore that everybody used with Backbone, or you could use it on your own. And he just rewrote the entire API as a drop-in replacement for Underscore, but it was like extremely performant, which is pretty neat. It's far past that now. It has added all kinds of really nice stuff to it as well. And then one other thing I guess we should say about Lodash is that you can also just pluck different methods that you like. So even the other day, I knew this, but the other day I asked on Twitter, what's the best... what's called like a nested get, like remember, sometimes you have an object that's like six or seven levels deep, mm-hmm. and you don't know if all of those six or seven levels deep are going to, like, you don't know if there's going to be a person object. And even when you have a person object, you don't know if there's going to be a name object. And then on that, you don't know if there's going to be a last name. So like you always have to check for everything along the way. Otherwise it's going to break.
No, I was going to say that's like a guaranteed ticket to a big old error if you're looking inside of a nested object, right? If you're not checking any of that stuff, right?
Exactly. So I asked, like, what's the best like standalone library for this? Because I'm still of like the mindset, like, don't bring a monolith library with you where you can just like take a little helper function. But Lodash will actually export every single one of its function with only the little piece that you actually need. So you can always just like grab a little, like sort of like tear off a function from Lodash and just put that one piece into your app. You can npm install lodash.has, lodash.get, lodash.nth-arg or over or any of these different arguments that it has. So there's no reason to have that sort of like bloat example that you've had before.
Yeah, and if you're working with sort of like you know, modern code splitting and you know, all that sort of stuff, you can install the entire Lodash package. And if you look in your if you're in your packages folder for Lodash, each one of those functions has its own file. So you can import the function directly from its own file and not have to import the entirety of Lodash. So that way, if your file's all code split and wrapped up correctly, you're only getting that one thing. And then you have access to the entire library too. So, I mean, a lot of different strategies for not having to load the entire library itself.
Exactly. That's sort of the beauty of using CommonJS or ES6 modules, is that you just grab the one thing that you want, and you can be sure that the module that you want will go off and get its dependencies. Maybe it has shared dependencies through a couple other modules, and it will pull those in. So, big fan of Lodash. If you haven't checked it out before or haven't used it before, definitely take a look at it.
Cool. Yeah, next up we have... one library that's extremely popular takes care of something that basically is sort of a pain to work with on your own, is dates and JavaScript and date and time and all that stuff, time zones. And that's Moment. Moment.js is a very popular library for working with date formats. It makes it really easy to change between time zones, format your dates, sort of pull dates, create dates, add to any sort of manipulation of time is Moment's strong suit, right? It becomes a really, really nice way of working with date and time.
Yeah, it's both for formatting time. So if you're coming from PHP world, where you have this really nice date function that you can pass like all these different like N and I and capital Y and get all the formatted date from that, you can pass those values to dot format on moment, and then it will then kick out the formatted value for you. But the other things that it does is it does relative time, which is like if you have like a blog post and you wrote it 2 seconds ago, mm-hmm. it's going to say 2 seconds ago. But if you wrote it 3 years ago, it's not going to say 3,000 seconds ago. It's going to say 6 years ago or however many years ago you wrote it. So you don't have to like worry about all those if statements that I myself have written 100 times. If the number of seconds is greater than show a day, and if it's more than 6 days, then show a week, and you get the point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like I said, it's no fun working in time and date usually, and in moment takes so many of the stressors out of it.
Yeah. One example I want to give of when I've recently used it is I built like a reporting dashboard for myself so I could see like how many sales I got in a specific day or whatever. And then I have a calendar picker, which is great, and you can pick different things. But then I put these like little handy buttons along the bottom that say today, yesterday, 2 days ago, this week, last 7 days, last 30 days, last 60 days, this month, last month, and then all the years and whatever. And those buttons were really easy to make. I didn't have to do any calculating. I just said for each of those buttons, like let's take last week, for example, what I would do is I would say, give me now, which is a moment, whatever today is, and then go to the start of last week or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then you can also include the entire week as well. Or if you want to do today, you can say, give me from whatever now is, it's 2:51, and you can go to start of today, mm-hmm. and go to end of day, or go to start of 30, or add 7 days or subtract 7 days. You get the point, right? You can do math as if it were English, but it will figure out all of the milliseconds of timing and including. I also, a couple months ago, I had a reporting bug in my affiliate system where I was not giving people affiliates for like, I think the last 4 hours. I forget what the bug was, but I had to go back and pay out a couple of people that I had missed there. And that was because I had tried to do the adding of the time myself, whereas using moment, it would be way easier.
Yeah, it's actually funny. You know, we both did the same technique there for our admin dashboards. It's funny because we've both built our own platforms for e-commerce and we've done it entirely yeah. separately, but it's hilarious to see how many like the same choices we've made. So I also did that exact same thing. I have that row of buttons. I mean, I obviously stole the idea from, you know, Stripe or YouTube, whoever has all those buttons. And but yeah, same exact thing. And Moment makes all that stuff easy.
That's really sweet. We should also talk about a sort of new-ish library called Date Functions, date-fns. And it sort of aims to be sort of the Lodash. Lodash was like an answer to some of the problems that Underscore had. One of the problems that Moment has is that it's starting to become a bit of a large library, and it's not extremely modular at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's probably going to change. But somebody has written Date Functions, which is a sort of a modular version of Moment. It does all the same stuff that Moment does. However, you can just cherry pick the different pieces of the library that you actually want to bring in from the library.
Now, I haven't looked at Date FNS enough. I mean, you shared it with me the other day, and I was really excited to see that this exists. But do you know about how it modifies the date? Because in Moment, if you're working with the date and you're changing, you're constantly having to use that clone method to create a new one, to create a new date to prevent you from manipulating something without setting it to a variable. Does date FNS function like that as well, or are you aware?
Yeah, it's one of the big reasons people have moved away from Moment is that it's mutable. Mm-hmm. You can mutate the actual date. That's what happens when you run a function against it. And the whole chant of the functional programming is make sure that everything is immutable, meaning that if you have a method that runs against an object, it shouldn't modify that original object. It should just return a new version of that. So one of the benefits to date functions is that it's immutable. It's a pure function, meaning that it's not going to overwrite the old one. It'll just return you an actual new version of it. So you can really shoot yourself in the foot sometimes there, where you don't necessarily know if a function is going to mutate your data or not, and you can sleep easy with date functions knowing that it is immutable.
Yeah, that's really nice, because I can't tell you how many times not having moment be immutable has caused bugs here or there, or just sort of weird mysterious things, and you're like, why is this? Oh yeah, I forgot it mutated the data. I wasn't expecting it to, and even though you set it to a new variable, it still mutated the original, causing you a whole bunch of headaches. So yeah, really excited to see that. I will have to be checking this out pretty significantly.
Yeah, it seems to be at a point where if you were needing a date function right now, I would probably reach for date functions instead of moment. That's not to poo-poo anything moment has done. Obviously, they have absolutely changed the way developers have worked with dates, but it looks like date functions is a bit more of a modern library for working with dates. And it, as far as I have worked with it, the examples that I gave earlier were actually all done with date functions, not with moment. All of the stuff has been transferred over to date functions. So all the functionality is there.
Nice. Yeah. And I heard moment is, well, I didn't just hear this. It's been this way for like the past 2 years now, or 3 years, whatever. Moment's not going, there's no updates to Moment, really, is there? There's nobody at the helm, or has that changed? Do you know about this?
I don't know. Let's see. Let's look at the commit history. I haven't heard that myself. The commit history looks pretty popular.
Okay, so it's still being updated. Maybe the original creator had abandoned it or moved on. I'm not positive. I remember seeing some posts about that, but it was a couple of years ago, so maybe that's since changed.
Maybe it looks like it's on its own like GitHub repo now, like moment.moment. Mm-hmm. So it probably is being actively worked on. So cool. I wouldn't write it off just yet.
Yeah, community takeover. Good.
Yeah. Cool. What do we got next in our list of things? One is called Slugify, and I'll give you a little hilarious story about how I came across this library. So a slug is, if you've used WordPress or anything like that, if you want to make a sentence into a URL friendly sentence without any of those like %20 when you have a space, you need a slug library that's going to convert it. Now, most slug libraries come with the entire Unicode list, meaning that if you have like a heart, it will say like I heart you, instead of like I emoji heart, or it will convert any Unicode symbols, emojis, to the actual English representation of them. And that's really cool, but I was doing a React application on the client side where I needed that, and it actually ended up making my bundle almost 3 megs.
Yikes.
So it's not something you can do. Sometimes you just reach for these libraries, you NPM install it, and you use it, and it works great locally because it's instant, but you have to be careful about the bundle size at the end of the day. So there's this library called Slugify that doesn't include any of that. It's a really small implementation of doing slugs. It does have the option to bring in Unicode if you need it on server side, but without it, you don't necessarily, you don't need it on the client side. So it's pretty simple. Takes in a sentence, will export out a URL-friendly slug that looks really nice.
Yeah, and so I actually use a different library for this same thing. I use one is Speaking URL. It's just all one word, Speaking URL. And
I've heard of this.
Yeah, and for me, I'm really only using this Slugify sort of technique. I'm pretty much only using it on the server, so I didn't look too hard at the bundle size because it's not affecting my client bundle, but it's pretty feature complete, has a lot of language stuff, and it was a nice and easy use for me. Just simply git slug, that's it. So for me, I use Speaking URL. It's fairly popular, has a good number of stars, and seems to be really active in development. So
that's pretty sweet. It looks like it says on the NPM repo that it is for client and browser, or sorry, client and server side. So you're up and running. Cool. That's good. I'll have to check that one out. At the end of the day, like sometimes these things do the exact same thing. And people love to talk about the differences between the two, but they they often just do the exact same thing, which is replacing spaces with dashes and comma stuff like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. It looks like speaking URL is 12K normally and 6.2K gzipped. So not too big there, but yeah, I only use it server side. But yeah, I mean, same for here. It's whatever works for you works. And if you don't need a library to make your slugs, you know, totally get it. If your slugs are very simple, if you want to make sure and, you know, take care of edge cases, like what emojis and or languages and all sorts of stuff like that, you might need a library to save yourself some time.
Totally. Next up, let's talk about data fetching. Mm-hmm. So on the client, we now have fetch, which is a built-in. Maybe we'll talk about the olden days. The olden days, we had jQuery's $.get or $.ajax, which it was a really nice API for actually fetching data. And then along came fetch built into the browser, and it's great, but sort of the downside to using fetch in the browser is that there are no good defaults, meaning that often these libraries will default to using JSON. And if you don't tell it that you're using JSON, or if you don't parse the JSON response in a second promise on fetch, it will break, so you have to make sure that you do that. And specifying headers and whatnot isn't necessarily the easiest. So when I am doing any sort of serious AJAX, if I'm just doing a quick demo, I'll use fetch. But whenever I'm doing some serious AJAX in the browser, I will reach for a library called Axios, which is by far, in my opinion, the best library, both on the client and on the server, for fetching data, pinging URLs, posting data to REST endpoints or submitting forms or anything like that. Have you used Axios before?
No, I've always used just fetch with the fetch polyfill from GitHub, you know, for browser support. But I haven't, I mean, the stuff you just said hit close to home with the, you know, the nice defaults. You know, there's absolutely nothing fun about setting your headers all the time and stuff like that. So, no, I'm going to give this library a look. I haven't, you know, I haven't done a ton of data fetching, to be honest. I work mostly with the YouTube API. But even then, you know, my system's in Meteor, and Meteor has their own fetching library, which is just HTTP get, which is really nice. And so for me, I haven't had a crazy amount of use for this, but I can see, you know, the benefits almost immediately and be totally psyched to use this.
It's really nice. And especially on when you're on the server side with Node, what everybody used for the longest time is a library called request. And Axios is all promise-based, meaning that you can use it with .then, or you can use async await if you have an async function. And then also has the ability to use something called cookie jar, which is you can sort of fake or hold cookies. If you're doing server-side requests, you don't really have the concept of cookies in your browser. So you can use this thing called cookie jar, which will allow you to save cookies and or fake cookies and submit them on every single request. So if you're doing any sort of scraping or logging into systems, that's going to be super helpful there.
Nice. I like the name too, Cookie Jar.
Yeah. Something about JavaScript, people are really good at naming their naming their projects.
Yeah, I know. It is an influencer whether or not I'm excited to use a library or not. It's got a sweet name. Maybe just a little bit more excited to use it. Yeah.
Exactly. There's also, this is something I haven't used before, but there's a caching plugin for Axios as well. So sometimes I implement my own caching, and I think like, maybe it'd be easier if there was just like something I could plug into the get library. So if I were to ping this URL again, then it would maybe deliver me a cache of that actual data. So pretty sweet. Check it out. Axios is really, really good.
Nice. Yeah. Next, I have one that's working with local storage variables, and this is just store.js, and it makes working with local storage as easy as like store.get or store.set. And because of that, you don't have to worry about any sort of browser versions, or you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. It just makes setting and saving information to local storage as easy as possible. Basically could not work with local storage as smoothly as without this.
That is pretty sweet. I actually have a local storage one as well. And this is something I use heavily on my website. Since the way that I do my courses is that I have a new domain name for every single one, I have a bit of trouble with syncing data between all of my actual websites. So what cross storage is from Zendesk. So if you've ever had like a chat pop up on a website, or had to do like, if you had like a file, an issue with someone, it's like a help desk software. They have this library called cross storage. And essentially the way that it works is that you create a hub. So you create a hub on one website, and that is your local storage hub. And then you can give it permissions on all of these other domains which you wish to share local storage between the two. So essentially we'll just pop up a little iframe in every other domain name. And then if you set local storage on one of your domain names, or if one of the other domain names set some data, it will sync between all of your domain names as if you were on a single domain name, but it will sync it between everyone. So I use that fairly heavily on my websites.
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty neat. Really super handy if you're working on a cross domain stuff.
Yeah, you definitely have to. It's pretty good in terms of telling you about the security of that, but you definitely need to check your stuff three times over, because whenever you're doing anything that is cross-domain, you need to be careful that you're not accidentally giving access to other domain names that should not have access to that data.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like if Scott were to, if you were to visit Scott's website, he shouldn't be able to load up my website in an iframe and grab all of the local storage data from that. That'd be a huge security issue.
Word.
Yeah. Next up, what do we got here? I got one called Faker.js. Mm-hmm. So if you've ever needed to create a bunch of fake data, whether it's names, last names, profiles, let's take a look here. What all?
Yeah, Faker is one of those libraries that if you are doing any sort of testing, or you're building out some default data in your system, you've probably come across Faker. It is really just, it's one of the coolest things ever to basically just implant a whole bunch of fake data. And it can come from anything, from photos to names to locations to any sort of data that you want.
Addresses,
yeah.
Postal codes, country codes, account names, credit cards, abbreviation, verbs, images. You get the point, right? It's tons and tons of fake data. And I always love using like good data when I'm making something. So rather than just like mashing your keyboard, it's nice to be able to fill it with some real world looking data.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're working in Teams and you need like a default set of data, it couldn't make it any easier to populate that database, right? So
yeah,
absolutely. Faker is a big one.
Big fan of that. I am going to take a break and talk about our sponsor. So our sponsor is FreshBooks, which is cloud accounting software. I use it myself to send out invoices to clients of mine anytime I need to be reimbursed for travel. Anytime I have an expense, what I'll do is I'll quickly, if I got a receipt in my pocket, I'll open it up. I'll snap a picture of the receipt. I'll input how much it was. And I can archive that receipt or throw it in the garbage. So anytime I have any sort of invoice that comes in, any sort of expense, and at the end of the year, what I do is I just hit export on all of the data from all of my invoices, all of my expenses, all of my clients, all of the different currencies. I know I have three or four different currencies at the end of the year. Give that all to my accountant, and he's really happy with that. I don't have to spend any time in it. I hate doing book stuff like that. I understand it. I just don't like doing it at all, because I'd rather be actually coding. So big fan of FreshBooks. I've been with them for about 7 years. If you want to get a 30-day free trial, go to freshbooks.com/syntax and make sure you enter in syntax in the how did you hear about us section. Thanks so much for them to sponsoring.
Cool. So let's get back into these utility libraries. I have I don't know if have you migrated over to React Router 4 for your stuff yet?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty bummed to learn that they don't have URL parameters anymore, like query parameters.
The parsing.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they sort of, I understand the take, right? So it's why include this when you could you need it, include it yourself, right? So
yeah.
Luckily, there's now in the browser a way to basically pull out these query parameters from your string, from your URL. But it's not totally browser compliant. So one thing I pretty much use all the time is this URL search params polyfill. And there's a couple of libraries here. I use the one that's URL hyphen search hyphen params hyphen polyfill. However, there's also one without the word polyfill that looks pretty popular as well. I don't know the difference between the two. I haven't really investigated that much. But it basically allows you to just parse your URL and grab out the query parameters or pretty much anything as you need without having to worry about browser compatibility.
I did not know that this was coming to the browser. So you're saying that, and this was actually one of my picks later, but if I have like a gnarly URL that's got a whole bunch of search params in it, like three or four, it will parse that, like it'll parse the string.
Yeah, so check out the Mozilla developer. It's called URL search params. Basically, it's utility methods for working with a string, URL string. Allows you to get all, has, keys, set, sort, to string, values, a whole bunch of stuff.
That's pretty sweet.
Yes, so this I guess, more of a polyfill than a library, but, you know.
Exactly. Well, I guess, like, the tip would be that the browser now has or will have this thing called URL search params, which if you've ever tried to parse a URL yourself, like, I always like, oh, how hard can it be? Split it on the ampersand and then split it, each one of those on the equal sign, and you can call it a day. But there's so much that goes into dealing with URL search params. So that is pretty neat. It looks like it's an iterable as well.
Yeah, I discovered this when I was just trying to solve that React Router 4 issue, found an issue queue about asking about query parameters in React Router, and someone recommended it in the issue queue. I'm just really psyched to learn that it exists. So nice.
That's pretty cool. Well, along the same, I guess the same idea of that is, there's a library called, or this little snippet called parseURI, which if you have an entire string and you need to get what is the domain name, what is the origin, what is the path, what is the hash, what is the, not just the search query after the question mark, this library will give you absolutely all of that, which is pretty sweet. And then I also, when I was doing this, I also found out that someone said that you can just do a document.create element and create like a blank link, and then set the href to whatever it is that you want. And then you can take that link and look for the protocol, host name, port, path name, search, and hash, which is pretty neat. Hmm. The one thing that it does not do is it will not chunk up your actual search. So if you have three or four things in your search, then you need to use your actual library there.
Gotcha. Cool.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah. Here's a library I use all the time for working with webhooks. Is ngrok. I don't know how to say this. It's ngrok, and it basically just exposes. It connects a port and opens it up so that you can hit that port. So if you're working locally and you need to test out your webhooks, what did I used to use? I used to use local tunnel, and local tunnel would essentially crash for me every 20 minutes to an hour, and you'd restart it would generate a new URL, so then you'd have to go back into Stripe, reset your webhook, reset your URL. And luckily I just sort of asked around on Twitter what people use, and this ngrok yep. was by far the most suggested. Used it, haven't had any issues with crashing, keeps the tunnel open, and has been making my life a lot better with working with webhooks there.
That's pretty sweet. I should say before we get 1,000 or Twitter replies that local tunnel does allow you to specify a domain name so that it will be consistent across. It will, if you do not give it a domain name, it'll give you a random key every single time. But it will allow you to say like WestBoss, and then it'll try to give you westboss.localtunnel.me if it's available. And then that's what I've used previously to keep your webhooks consistent.
Oh, nice. But you don't have issues with it stopping after a period of time?
No, I've heard a couple other people, which is why people really like ngrok. So I've heard it's really good, but I am a big fan of a tool called Browser Sync, and Browser Sync has local tunnel baked right in, and you can just pass it a URL. And I use that a lot because if I need to either do a webhook or show somebody a website that is only local, or I want to open it up on my phone and it's only on my computer, it will just expose it via an external URL. I guess we'll do a whole show on like kind of cool tools like that as well, though.
Cool tools. Tasty, delicious, cool tools. Okay, cool. So, yeah, what else we got here?
I got one called Async, which was massive in the Node community a couple of years ago, and it's still really, really popular. A lot of people don't use it anymore because we now have promises and async await, but there's this library called Async, and it essentially allows you to do really good flow control in your application. So, like, let's say, for example, you're trying to charge somebody's credit card and create an account. There might be four or five steps where you validate their data, you charge the credit card, you create an account, you check if there's actually an account or whatever needs to go on in between that. And if you were doing that just with callbacks, it would really quickly get into what's called callback hell. Mm-hmm. So what Async allows you to do is like, there's all these different methods that live inside of Async. Like there is, you can run parallel, you can run them after a series, you can run them in waterfall where you do one, you pass the result to the next one, and you pass the result to the next one. A lot of these are now obsoleted by Async Await, but some of them where if you need to do some like really heavy stuff, like for example, I was updating 100,000 records and my computer couldn't do all of them at once, but I also didn't want to do one at a time. So I think there's like, you can do like, I forget what it is, but you can say like, do at least five at once or do at most 12 at once. And if you ever have any sort of like complicated flow control where you need your code to run as fast as possible and make a lot of sense, take a look at the methods of async. So the way I think about it is that like Lodash is this like helper methods for dealing with data. Async is a whole bunch of helper methods for dealing with complicated flow control where things need to happen asynchronously and synchronously at different times.
Nice.
Yeah, big fan of it. What else do we got from you, Scott? Anything else?
Here. I might have hit my limit of utility libraries. I don't know. I think a good suggestion is to also don't be afraid to roll your own utility library. I know we mentioned before that, you know, you might end up building up maybe either a large file or a folder structure of files, but even creating helpers for your own code, whether it's you don't like a particular library's API and you want to maybe change it, or there's one particular function that you're writing all the time and you want to write some defaults for yourself, writing these like helper methods or helper functions for yourself could be a really super useful way to save yourself some time overall, as long as it's you're using things like bundling and stuff like that and you're not bundling a whole bunch of helper functions that you don't need, you know? So yeah, totally. I guess that's not necessarily a library, but yeah, don't be afraid to write your own helpers.
I think that's really important, especially if you are in the interviewing stage right now, because often what interview questions are these things that you go, I don't know. I would have just used Lodash for that. So if you can like be like, huh, I wonder how I would do that without Lodash. It's sort of like when we transition from jQuery to vanilla, you'd be like, how would I do that without jQuery? Maybe challenge yourself and say like, how would I do that without Lodash? How would I just write that in just vanilla JavaScript?
And the best part about all of that is you have a really awesome answer sheet. If you want, like, you challenge yourself to do this, and then you can go look at the code of Lodash and just say, oh, this is how they're doing it. And you know that because of, you know, who's behind Lodash, you know that their solution is going to be top notch. Like, so you can look at that code and learn so much about JavaScript and maybe compare yours to that and think about how could you have changed your thinking to make it a little bit better based on what they're doing in other libraries, right?
Totally. So I got one more here that I'll say. I've got a couple others, but I think that they're better suited to a different episode. But this one is called bling.js, and it's not even a library. It's just a gist from Paul Irish that he made this years and years ago. And essentially what it is when we moved over, or if you've moved over from jQuery, you're used to like the dollar sign selector to grab things, and you're used to the nice dot on method, which will bind to add event listener. So what bling.js will do is it will make window.dollar equal to document.query selector. Mm. So instead of saying document.query selector all, you will just say dollar, and then that will go off and select all the items for you. If you've done my Node course, you know that this is actually, we use a bit of a modified version in my Node course of this, just because it's so much easier. And then it will also modify the prototype of a node, which is every element on the page. And it will just, it basically just takes dot add event listener and makes it dot on. So you can just chain dot on onto your elements. And then there's a couple other things that it does. Oh yeah, if you can use dot on, which will loop over. So like, for example, if you have a node list that's 6 or 7 items, you know you have to loop over and attach an event listener to each one. This will just say dot on, and it'll attach that event listener to every single one of them without you having to explicitly loop on it. So it's tiny, it's 15 lines long, but it makes life a lot easier, especially if you're used to the nice API that jQuery gives you, and the vanilla API is not so nice.
Nice. Yeah, love that. I mean, anyone who's grew up with jQuery or has used jQuery extensively, you know, some of the stuff is one of the main reasons why you didn't want to go to just plain vanilla JS, right? I mean, just having those long sort of just methods that you have to remember, the technique's a little bit different. You have to worry about browser edge cases. So it's nice having stuff like this to sort of ease that pain a little bit.
Yeah, and there have been people that have taken this and built it out a little bit further. So if you look up bling.js, you'll also find some GitHub repos. I believe what they also do is, they added was the ability to, if you select a node list and there's nothing found and you try to chain .on or .add event listener to it, it will fail silently, which is, again, that's what jQuery does. And if you try to call the .add event listener against an empty node or something that is undefined, you're going to get that problem. Cannot read property or cannot call method at event listener of undefined. So it's kind of a slippery slope, because then your mind starts going, and before you know it, you've created your own jQuery.
Yeah.
But I think adding a couple lines to your code base for bling.js is totally worth it if you're doing a lot of vanilla DOM interaction stuff.
Cool. Love it.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, these have been some tasty JavaScript
tasty
utility treats.
Well, let's move into our sick picks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got for a sick pick today, Scott?
Yeah, today my sick pick is a Satechi USB hub. So Satechi makes some really nice looking products, by the way. I discovered them when Wes and I both recently got the new MacBook Pros, which have bunch of USB-C ports, which obviously don't connect to a whole lot. So, you know, we've been living the dongle life, and Wes recommended the CalDigit past couple of videos ago, and that one is a brilliant solution for if you need a lot, right? You're driving two monitors, right? And it powers itself, so it functions your power cord and stuff like that. I didn't need all that stuff. I'm only driving one monitor. Granted, it is a ultra wide.
Weak.
Yeah, it's ultra wide.
Okay,
it's a 4K ultra wide.
Ultra wide.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Carry on.
It's 38 inches, man. This thing is huge. It's seriously ridiculous. But
is it 4K?
It's not. They say it's 4K, but it's not truly 400 pixels. I would have to check the exact dimensions.
It's close because it's long.
It's close because it's long. Yeah, it's 344 by 1440 tall. It's super wide, and it's curved. It's awesome. But either way, I didn't need to drive multiple monitors, just one. And Yeah, this thing's great because it has power pass-through. So you plug your MacBook power into one end of it, and then it has three USBs, it has Ethernet, and it has HDMI, and then an SD card and a micro SD card. So they make a whole bunch of different ones of all different shapes and sizes based on your needs. But the one I got was this Type-C 4K Ethernet adapter. It was $89. It has really stepped up my dongle game pretty heavy. I actually recently got gigabit internet over here, so I got 1,000 up and 1,000 down
Wow.
in my office. Yeah, so I really needed that Ethernet wired up to take full advantage of that. So this thing has been making my network fly.
That's sweet. So you just plug this little thing. Am I looking at it right now where it has two USB-C connectors and it kind of just clips into the side?
No, so I got the Type-C multi-port adapter, and it's
Oh, I see it.
Yeah, so it only takes up one. I didn't want it to take up two. The other one potentially could have taken up your headphone or your headphone jack and stuff on the one side. So this one's a little bit more flexible, maybe a little less features. I'm not quite positive about that, but it has served me well in these past like two weeks that I've had it.
Pretty sweet. What color did you get?
Oh, I got the space gray because you got to get matchy with the laptop.
It's the only way you can go. Yeah. Good. I got space gray too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know why Apple didn't do this sooner. I think people have been asking for like a black or a darker aluminum laptop forever. So I'm pretty psyched about the space gray.
Cool. Well, my pick of the sick pick is a book called Essentialism. And this is a book that I read or audiobooked maybe 6 months ago, and I'm getting back into it again. I'm just going to give it another listen because it was so good. I often don't like leave books being like, wow, that was amazing. But this Essentialism book essentially just makes you look at your life and cut out the stuff that you don't need. So I think everybody's a little bit oversubscribed these days. I think as I get busier, I realize that like I like to say yes to a lot of things, but then I often find myself looking back and being like, why did I say yes to this? Or, oh, it's so annoying that I got to spend a whole day doing X, Y, or Z. Or I much rather just be doing the core fundamental thing that is running my business, which is creating courses. That's at the end of the day, that's what all it is. So this Essentialism book is fantastic in that it shows you how to cut out stuff and how to evaluate the different things in your life of whether they would be worth doing or how to evaluate what you should actually be spending time on in both your business and your life. So
is this,
it's a fantastic book. Yeah, go ahead.
Is this Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less? Is this the book?
That's it.
Okay, cool. Just making sure I'm looking at the right one.
Greg McCowan is the author of this one. And I got it on audiobook about 6 months ago. I definitely recommend the audiobook or the hardcover if you prefer to read, but it's something that I'm constantly doing. There's a really good quote by the quote is, if it's not a hell yes, it's a no.
Hmm.
And that's by, let me get the author of that.
I already like that quote. It's sitting well with me right now.
It's like one of my favorite people ever. It's the guy behind CD Baby.
Oh, yeah, I remember CD Baby.
I got to figure this out. It's going to bug me. Derek Sivers, he said, if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. And he has another really good book that I'll probably recommend at another one. But essentially, if something is not getting you super excited, then it's probably not something that you should be taking on. And I'd be careful with that because sometimes people shy away from stuff because they're a little bit intimidated or they're nervous about taking on something that's a little bit past them. But I often find myself regretting items that were only like, that could be cool. I'll do it. But when really it should have been, this is not a hell yes, I'm cutting it out of my life.
Yeah. And that's one of those things you have to practice. I am the exact same way. And as many times as you actually, you know, can you know, praise yourself for saying no to stuff, it is really easy to creep back in. And then, you know, you'll find yourself a month later being like, oh, wait, I should have said no to all this stuff. I thought I was doing really well. I know I'm the exact same way. I say yes to way too much stuff, and it cheapens everything you do, right? Because no longer are you going to get to do that much attention to any individual thing. So I'm going to have to read this. Yeah. I have not. I will put it on audiobook because I'm not a talented reader. So
awesome. Let's move on to our last section, which is shameless plugs. And I actually don't want to plug my own stuff today. I want to plug a friend of mine. I don't know. I'll call him a friend, and I'm going to totally butcher his name. Dinesh Gajar. I'm so sorry if I just totally butchered that. But what happened is that every time we release a Syntax episode, he creates this really cool like photoscape of what the episode is about. So for example, like the tooling one, he got a picture of his iPhone. He put a bunch of tools around it. Or for my origin story, he got a like kind of like a Superman, but with like a really hilarious shirt that I would wear and put it underneath.
I thought that shirt was on point. Yeah.
Or like the money one, he put like the picture of the iPhone and it looks like Wi-Fi, but with actual money on top. So he spends a lot of time on these. I think they're really cool, pretty cool. I've actually since hired him to do some design work for me, which is, I guess, a pro tip on how to get noticed. It's worked well. But the stuff he's been doing is just amazing. And also, if you go on his Instagram, it's Dinesh, DHANISHGAJJAR. Right now he's doing these CSS flags where he's doing every flag in the world in pure CSS. And it's just blowing my mind of how cool it is.
Yeah, so I've been following that too. I really liked his solutions to some of that stuff. So like when he runs into maybe a tricky flag, I've been really liking to see what he comes up with. So yeah.
Yeah. It's very, he always talks about like problems that he's having, which I love seeing people work out in the open like that. So definitely check out his Instagram. He posted to Twitter as well, but the Instagram is, I think, kind of, he's got almost 6,000 followers on Instagram. So that's probably quite a few who are already following him.
Dope. Yeah, so my shameless plug, I'll follow your lead and plug something that's not my own. Actually, it's kind of my own in a way. I made a video on Level Up Tutorials last week. You can check it out right now about easy snippets. Yeah, so this tool was created by Pavel Guzbek, and it's basically a website that allows you to paste in some code, and then there's three tabs. There's a VS Code, a Sublime, or an Atom tab, and it outputs the snippet syntax. So if you're big into writing code snippets in any of those editors, you will know that, especially in VS Code, it's a pain because each new line has to be its own string. You can't do like a multi-line string with it like you can in Atom. So this just takes away all of that stuff. You just enter the snippet name, you paste in your code, and you know, blow, you get your snippet shout out to you that you can just paste right into VS Code. So awesome work by Pavel there. I've been just tweeting about it. I've had it on my YouTube channel. So if you follow me in any capacity, you've probably seen this already, but seriously, excellent
work. What is the URL for it?
It's his website. You'll want to just either go to my channel, go to the video and click on it, or hit up his
show notes.
Yeah, show notes. Exactly. We'll link to it in there. So it's Pavel's website. He has a Polish last name, so I don't want to have people try to type that out every time, you know, as someone with a Polish last name themselves knows the how well that works out.
Yeah, I think everybody gets their last name butchered. I often get Bose.
Which,
yeah makes sense, but it's Boss. Cool. Well, that's it for this week. Hopefully you enjoyed it. If you have ideas for the show, anything you'd like to see us covered, make sure you hit us up. We're on Twitter. I'm at WestBoss, and Scott is
at S. Tolinski.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, and we'll see you in the next one.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all our shows. Don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player and drop a review if you'd like this show. Until next time, peace.